Introduction, updated May 2023. The innovation of chartering is thriving, but has only begun to reach its full potential. I woke up one morning in December 2010, and it hit me like a bolt of lightning. The next year, 2011, was the 20th anniversary of the passage of the first chartered school law in Minnesota. If I was ever to write the story of chartered schools, that was the time. Zero Chance of Passage, the pioneering charter school story, was published in 2012, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the opening of City Academy in St. Paul, Minnesota, the first charter school in the nation. Fast forward to spring 2023 as I record this audio version of my book. Love 'em or hate 'em, charter schools have now endured for over 30 years and are here to stay. Since the 2005-2006 school year, the number of charter schools and campuses in the nation has more than doubled, while charter school enrollment has more than tripled. In 2022, the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools, the Alliance, reported that 45 states, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and Guam had chartering laws. During the 2020-21 school year, over 3.7 million students attended over 7,800 charter schools and campuses nationwide, under the guidance of 205,600 charter school teachers. Charter schools enrolled 7.5% of all public school students in the nation, up from 6.8% in 2019-2020. Five states accounted for more than half of all charter school enrollment: California, Texas, Florida, Arizona, and New York. Geographic demographics remain consistent over time. In 2020-2021, 57.3% of charter school students were urban, 29.3% suburban, with the remainder, 13.4%, located in towns or rural America. To a surprising extent, chartering has taken hold in some large urban districts. Top districts for percent of charter school enrollment were New Orleans, Louisiana, with 98.8% charter students, San Antonio, Texas, with 54.2%, Indianapolis, Indiana, with 47%, Washington, D.C., 44.3%, and Detroit, Michigan, 40.7%. The Los Angeles and New York City school districts had the greatest numbers of charter school students enrolled, with nearly 157,000 students in Los Angeles and over 138,000 students in New York City. Charter schools serve a majority, nearly 70%, of Black and Brown students, with 30.7% white students. Nearly 60% of charter school students are eligible for free and reduced price lunch. Though the charter school movement has grown and evolved, the original historical memoir documented in this pioneering charter school story remains the same. We are fortunate to have this opportunity in May 2023 to update the introduction and epilogue to this history, which will bookend the story. I am grateful to the National Charter Schools Founders Library, charterlibrary.org, for making this new audiobook and ebook version of Zero Chance of Passage available to our chartering community and beyond. So, what has sustained this redesign in public education through 30 years of highs and lows? What lessons about chartering must we learn if it is to be sustained and grown over the next 30 years? What contributions has the chartering sector made to public education in general? What insights can be applied to redesigning other public schools and public services? This book will not focus on whether chartered schools have been successful. The literature is filled with studies that support every point of view on that question. No. This book will tell the pioneering story of chartering from its early origins, the turmoil of its legislative passage in Minnesota, and its explosion onto the national stage within weeks thereafter. There are many lessons to be learned from this story. Chartering is here to stay. It is a fundamental reform of our public education system. We must understand its past if we are to inform the future of chartering around the nation and world. In writing this book, I hoped to achieve three things that will shape the future of chartering. 1. Set the historical record straight. 2. Reclaim the urgency of why chartering came to be. 3. Reshape the conversation around chartering for the next decade. Frankly, this is a better story than I initially expected to write. After working from 1989 to 1991 as the Senate author of the chartering legislation in Minnesota, I was devastated when the bill finally passed into law in 1991. I thought it was too compromised to allow a chartered school to open. I thought I'd failed all who traveled the road with me. 30 years later, I now recognize that without this compromise in 1991, chartering might never have happened at all. And the success of the first chartering legislation was a result, in part, of the political winds of the times. Frankly, chartering might not have happened in another political era, certainly not in the political times of today. I expected this story to be an account of us against them, education reformers versus the teacher unions. I was a union-endorsed DFLer. In Minnesota, the Democratic Party is known as the Democratic Farmer Labor, or DFL Party. At the time, I saw the unions as overly aggressive opponents of new legislation that would provide new opportunities for kids. To me, the contrast in our positions was black and white. Not so. Years later, I found many shades of gray in this story, and I learned that the story of chartering and unions continues to evolve today in new and innovative ways. That, above all, gives me hope that this book can help allay the ongoing battles and controversy around chartering that continue in many areas of our nation today. Setting the historical record straight. Over the years, I've been heartened, at least up to 2016, by increasing bipartisan acceptance of chartering in Minnesota and around the nation. At the same time, I've been disheartened by widespread lack of understanding of chartering and why this change in our public education system came to be. Myths about chartering abound. I've heard policymakers from other states proclaim that chartered schools are non-public schools developed by supporters of private school vouchers. Democratic lawmakers back in the day asked why I supported this, quote, President Bush initiative, unquote. More recently, some Democratic lawmakers stepped back from chartering because messaging during the administration of President Donald Trump sometimes conflated public charter schools with private and religious schools. This conflation fed into the confusion and controversy that has existed around chartering since its origins. In various polls since 2006, only about a third of the American public identified chartered schools as the public schools they are. More than a third defined them as private or religious schools, and the rest didn't know. This fundamental misunderstanding impacts public support for chartering. Up to 2016, annual polling by Kappen Magazine had shown consistent two-thirds support of chartering by the American public. Two-thirds. There is not much else that two-thirds of Americans support today. But as these myths took hold, public support began to drop. And this may be related to other polling that shows that only about one-third of Americans support public dollars going to private and religious schools in the form of vouchers. There are other long-time myths, usually about how charter school funding flows. While some lament that chartering takes away funding from district public schools, the funding merely follows the student to another public school, just as if the student moved to another public school district or open enrolled into another public school in the state. Chartering merely provides the students and families with access to more public schools. I wrote this book to record the pioneering story of chartering as it happened in the words of the people who were there. I am grateful that 15 people involved in the creation and passage of chartering legislation added their historical perspective in interviews for this book in 2011. I am grateful to Ted Coldery, a policy entrepreneur whose persistent vision has guided us on the long trek of chartering. In the least of his contributions, Coldery recorded much of the history of chartering in memoranda. When I retired from the Minnesota Senate in late 2000, I brought home a large file drawer full of papers and documents filled with Coldery's memos, printed articles he provided from around the country, and his records of endless meetings during that time period. If there are three key historical points I hope people take away from this story, they are these. 1. Chartering is a bipartisan policy initiative. 2. Chartering came from the middle of the political spectrum. 3. Chartering came from outside the traditional political system. As a legislative author of chartering who lived through this daily history, I thought I had a good idea of what went on during the origins of chartering. Not true. I realized in writing this book that I knew just a fraction of this history. For instance, I was always astonished that the chartering idea spread to the national scene so quickly after passage in Minnesota. Years later, no one was more surprised than I, or Coldery, to learn that Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton had been traveling the country with Coldery's exclusive franchise paper in hand, talking about chartered schools, even as I and others struggled to pass the bill back in Minnesota. That's why it's important that this history be recorded now. None of us involved in the birth of chartering knew the whole story. We each contributed parts of it. This book brings the whole story together for the first time. There is another reason to preserve the historical legislative record. It doesn't currently exist in a public forum. A law student once asked me about the legislative history of chartered schools in Minnesota. She said she couldn't find anything on the legislative audio tapes at the Minnesota Historical Society. She was right. Very little was there. Outcome-based schools, the original term in the legislation for chartered schools, was mentioned only a handful of times in debate in the House and the Senate, often in the context of a much larger debate on a much larger education funding bill. That's it. Passage of chartering legislation was anything but Civics 101. If anyone is to believe the chartering story, it had to be written and preserved. This historical record has since become the foundation of the National Charter School's Founders Library, charterlibrary.org. Established in 2017 under the leadership of Dr. Jim Gunner, President and CEO of the National Charter Schools Institute, the Founders Library is now a national resource of historical records, timelines, oral histories, and more. The Founders Library is our way of grounding the original ideas and opportunities presented by this important institutional and systemic reform. It is intended to be a resource for educators, policymakers, researchers, media, and others interested in learning about the legislative intent and evolution of chartering. The Founders Library is already proving to be a valuable resource. Historical records and recordings from the founders are being cited in court documents, legislative hearings, administrative proceedings, and more at the state and federal level. Examples are illustrated in the epilogue. Reclaiming and restoring the urgency. Over the last 30 years, I've watched the growth of the chartering sector with great pride. I've also watched the growth of chartered schools with increasing concern as to their future. For me, the breakthrough innovation in chartering was always about the law itself, the restructuring of the dynamics of the public education system. The schools themselves are important, but the lasting legacy is the systemic, institutional innovation that created a new way for public schools to be created and operated outside the district system. I expected some chartered schools would do very well, while others would not succeed. The purpose of the chartering legislation was to give freedom to parents and teachers to create new schools outside the existing system. These schools would offer new opportunities for students. Chartering would become the research and development sector of public education. These schools would be held accountable through performance-based outcomes in a contract overseen by an authorizer, such as a university or state board of education. The authorizer would require chartering leaders to deliver quality education results. If they did not do so, or their innovation did not work, they would be closed. How many district public schools close for accountability reasons? They don't. Chartered schools allow the freedom to be better. To me, that means two things: the freedom to excel and to innovate. Both are fundamental to the origins of the chartering movement. Quality and innovation work hand in hand. There are many examples of this integration in chartering. Longer school days, year-round schooling, customized learning strategies, technology options, and subject-focused schools such as environmental or art schools have seen great success in urban, suburban, and rural chartered schools around the country. That being said, I have two concerns about how chartering has evolved. First, there are too many poorly performing chartered schools not living up to high standards of quality. If chartering is to succeed into the future, charter authorizers must close poorly performing schools. Period. As Newark Mayor Cory Booker said at the 2011 National Charter Schools Conference, "If we begin to protect charters just because they are charters, we have failed as a movement. We cannot condone mediocrity. Those charter schools need to improve or move aside and let someone else do the job." At the same national conference, Dr. Howard Fuller, director of the Institute for the Transformation of Learning at Marquette University and then board chair of the Black Alliance for Educational Options, did not mince words. "Bureaucratic creep has come into the chartering movement. We need to push people to be honest and innovative. As a movement, we must shut down every school that is ill-serving our kids." That brings me to my second concern. In our quest to close poorly performing schools, I worry that some may ignore the other fundamental issue that brought chartering to where it is today: the opportunity for innovation. On the policy level, recall that the original chartering legislation was enabling legislation, allowing schools the opportunity to do different, as Ted Coldery would say. Has the focus in the national chartering sector on model laws over the years reduced the motivation and perhaps incentive for more innovation? Of course, schools that profess to offer innovative learning must also be schools of quality. But is there a risk that innovation may be squelched by divergent definitions of quality or startup timelines that don't allow innovations to take hold? Many people today, even within chartered schools, have no idea why charters came to be. Chartering advocates cannot forget why we are here: to improve delivery of public education by allowing the freedom to be better. We can't become new protectors of the status quo or of the mediocre. What system could ever make progress if it were limited to doing only what has worked well in the past? We can't be afraid to close down a school that is not worthy of being open. We cannot be afraid to push educators in chartered schools to create better, higher-performing, higher-quality schools. We cannot be afraid to push them to innovate and try new ways of learning, new ways of organizing, new ways of managing, and new ways of motivating. We cannot be afraid to push them to create new ways to measure student achievement and other quality outcomes beyond traditional standardized test scores. We mustn't be afraid to push them to meet the needs of students, especially those students whose needs are not being met in district public schools. And we cannot be afraid to push back on the political forces from both the right and left that want to make the innovation of chartering policy something it is not. We need to protect and preserve the original principles and components of chartering from relentless attempts to undermine chartering laws around the country. Forces on the left, often involving teacher unions, have tried and succeeded in some cases in modifying charter state laws or federal policies to reduce charter school independence and autonomy. Strategies include 1. Adding more regulation, 2. Requiring collaboration with public school districts, 3. Requiring community needs assessments to open a school, 4. Allowing only school districts to be authorizers, and 5. Controlling the funding flow to charter schools, among other attempts. Forces on the right, often involving conservative think tanks, religious or private school entities, have tried and are coming close to succeeding in modifying charter school laws to privatize them in certain ways, or to allow public funding to flow to charter schools that provide religious curriculum. If these modifications from either the left or right are made to a charter school law, they are no longer laws that reflect the principles and values of chartering. In my view, we need to call these laws something else. We must understand our history to reclaim it. For chartering to thrive into the future, we must restore the urgency that brought it about over 30 years ago. Reshaping the chartering conversation of the future. As we move into the fourth decade of chartering, the concept appears to be stalled in young adulthood. If we are to reclaim the urgency of chartering, we must also redirect the conversation for the next decade. We need to create a new conversation. Chartering is not about a particular kind of school. It is not about the success or failure of any one learning strategy. It is a process, not an end in itself. It is about creating new opportunities for children and stimulating the larger public education system to become more responsive to the needs of students, families, and educators. The first step in changing the chartering conversation is to create consistent, values-based messaging that focuses on what chartering is rather than what it is not. The National Charter Schools Founders Library, charterlibrary.org, created a messaging guide for the 30th anniversary of chartering based on research conducted by Frank Luntz in fall 2020. Key messages of Chartering 101 include: charter schools are public, free, and open to all students regardless of zip code, race or ethnicity, income or ability level. Charter schools are part of the public education system and reflect the diversity of the communities we serve. There are no tests, entrance exams, or other special requirements for admission to a charter school. Charter schools are independently managed public schools that receive public funding based on the number of students enrolled. Charter schools give passionate teachers the flexibility to teach creatively and deliver the individualized education that every student deserves. Charter schools provide new opportunities for students, families, and educators. Every child deserves an equal opportunity to succeed. It is important that chartering advocates stay with high-level messaging rather than constantly feud with critics. Chartering leaders must be vigilant in their own use of language. How many times have we heard the phrase, quote, charter and public, unquote, schools? No wonder over one-third of Americans think charter schools are private schools. We must consistently challenge journalists and colleagues to accurately describe the distinction of charter and district or traditional schools. Yes, Messaging and language are important, as is powerful storytelling in concise 2-minute stories. But we must also ask the right questions to generate a better conversation by which everyone can benefit. Here are some questions to ask if we want to further public education in this country for all public education students, including students at chartered schools. 1. What changes have taken place because of chartering? What new strategies, discussions, and learning technologies were stimulated by chartering? Can research help here, perhaps more than it has? 2. How have chartered and district schools shared strategies and innovations and learned from one another? 3. What innovations and positive results can chartering bring about in the next 30 years for the entire educational system? 4. What are we doing in the chartering sector that we can and must stop doing? 5. What outcomes have we not been able to achieve even with the freedoms of chartering? How can we achieve those outcomes? 6. What freedoms were promised that never came to be? How can the multi-layered regulatory system be redesigned for all schools? 7. How can we find and build on common ground with those who have opposed or still oppose chartering? 8. How can rapidly developing digital technologies be accommodated and encouraged in all public schools? 9. How can the principles of chartering be applied to other public schools and governmental services? In successful redesign of government services, asking the right questions is more important than coming up with the perfect solutions. That is what brings stakeholders to the next right answer. Think of the creativity we could generate across the public school sector with robust discussions around these questions. Some of this, of course, is already happening. New learning technologies are flourishing, such as setting and enforcing high expectations, like at the KIPP schools. Some district schools work in partnership with charters, even co-locating in the same building. Teacher cooperatives have formed with professionals who seek ownership and freedom in helping students learn in new and creative ways. Examples abound, we just don't hear much about them. Today, the conversation is often one of controversy because we are focused on the wrong questions. It's not about which school or system is better or which learning method is better. We are expending enormous energy and resources on these debates, and little comes from it in the way of improving public education. It takes boldness to rise above and redirect this conversation. But with skilled, courageous, and committed leaders, we can do so. Educators in our district schools and chartered schools all want the same thing: to deliver quality public education to our children. Our nation depends on it. Let's stop the battles about which is the better way. Let's change the conversation to how we can invest that energy into creative ideas and teaching opportunities that benefit all children in public education. In a commentary following this story, former Minneapolis Federation of Teachers President Louise Sundin provides an insightful, fresh start to that conversation. And it's an example of how this union continues to lead. In 2011, the state of Minnesota approved the Minnesota Guild of Public Charter Schools as a single-purpose chartered school authorizer, which was proposed by the leadership of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. This was the first such union-initiated authorizer in the country. What can chartering cause in the next 30 years? Start with a new conversation around new questions focused on the greater good for all public school students. The innovation of chartering is thriving, but has only begun to reach its full potential.